From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Mitt Romney jumped into dangerous waters Tuesday when he told a crowd in South Carolina that his personal tax rate was maybe 15%. It highlighted how someone who's accumulated maybe a $250 million fortune gets very favorable tax treatment from the federal government. This hour on Point, we'll look at tax equity, tax reality, and a controversial proposal to tax not just the income, but the accumulated wealth of America's rich. Directly, you can join the conversation. What do you make of Mitt Romney's tax rate? Should the government actually tax wealth? Is that how the Paris Hiltons and the Warren Buffetts would pay a fair share or not? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's that moment, the Mitt Romney moment, at a stop in Florence, South Carolina on Tuesday, explaining why his tax rate was about maybe 15%.
What's the effective rate I've been paying? It's probably closer to the 15% rate than anything, because my last 10 years, my income comes overwhelmingly from investments made in the past rather than ordinary income or rather than earned annual income. I got a little bit of income from my book, but I gave that all away. And then I get speaker's fees from time to time, but not very much.
Speaker's fees, $375,000 last year. Not much in the world of Mitt Romney and maybe many others. Newt Gingrich was quick to respond on the campaign trail to the news that Romney's tax rate was around 15%, made a reference here to his own flat tax plan and Romney's rate.
I think that we ought to rename our flat tax. We have a 15% flat tax, so this would be the Mitt Romney flat tax that all Americans could then pay the rate Romney paid. I think that's terrific.
There's a lot of ferment around taxes and tax rates right now. More today with the news that Mitt Romney has some millions stashed in the often tax-free Cayman Islands, though he says that's not the case in his case. We'll hear in a moment from Stanford's Ronald McKinnon, whose recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal was headlined, "The Conservative Case for a Wealth Tax." But first, for the latest on Romney's taxes and more, we're joined by Donald Marin, director of the Tax Policy Center in Washington. He's a former acting director of the Congressional Budget Office. Donald Marin, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
First, just the basics. Remind us why it would be that Mitt Romney, with what we're told maybe a $250 million fortune and a lot of income off of that, would be paying something like 15% in income taxes.
Well, for income that shows up in the form of a capital gain, so say you own a stock and then you sell it and the gain on that, or in dividends, that's taxed. The highest tax rate on that at the moment is 15%, and so I suspect that's what's driving his estimate.
Pretty much simple as that. He's out there with tax plans as well. So are the other Republican candidates, and you've been looking at those tax plans and how they would affect the U.S. deficit, which has been a big issue in this country, especially in Republican circles lately. What do you see on the Republican contender side, those who have clear plans out there? What do they look like and what would the impact be, Donald?
Well, of the ones we've had enough detail to analyze, of which the remaining candidates, that would be Mr. Romney, Santorum, and Gingrich, not surprisingly, all of them propose significant tax cuts. They'd all, in one way or another, you know, extend all of the tax cuts that were originally enacted in 2001 and 2003 that expire at the end of the year. They would all repeal the tax increases that were included in the health reform bill. They would all reduce tax rates on capital gains and dividends, and they would all cut the corporate tax rate, which is currently 35%, the second highest in the world, to some lower level. So they have some things in common. They differ a lot in the details, though. Among them, while Romney's would be a significant tax cut, it frankly pales in comparison to the size of the tax cut that Senator Santorum, former Senator Santorum, or former Speaker Gingrich proposed. Their tax cuts on the individual taxes and corporate taxes and capital gains taxes, when you add them all together, would exceed about $1 trillion a year.
So just to get the picture here, I'm reading you quoted as saying that Romney's plan would raise the deficit by how much over what period?
Well, so there's some horrible, hideous issues your listeners don't want to know about how you measure all of these things, but view him as increasing the deficit in a single year by somewhere between $200 billion and $600 billion.
In a single year. And Newt Gingrich would raise it by the deficit by how much with his...
So depending how you measure it, it would be between $900 billion and $1.3 trillion.
And Rick Santorum?
Would be the same as Gingrich.
So any place from $600 billion to over a trillion in the space of 1 year?
Yes.
And what about where the weight of taxes would fall? That's the issue that's been raised in part with Romney's revelation about his tax rate. I'm reading you quoted here saying that the taxes of people earning more than $1 million a year would be cut under the Romney plan by almost $300,000 a year.
Yes. So Romney does a couple of things, of which the most important for high-income folks is he proposes a reduction in the corporate tax rate and also the elimination of estate taxes. And, you know, when you track those through, you know, most economists believe that corporate income taxes are ultimately borne in significant measure by folks who are investors. And so as a result, those tend to be high-income people. And obviously people who end up paying the estate tax when they die tend to be very wealthy people. And so the combination of eliminating the estate tax and cutting corporate rates significantly means you're going to have a significant tax cut at the high end.
Donald Marin, we've got a lot of tax decisions coming up in this year, even before the election in the fall, do we not?
We have an enormous number of decisions. We've unfortunately gotten in a situation where almost the entire tax code is temporary. There are major temporary cuts in the payroll tax, in the income tax, in the estate tax, and in the corporate income tax, all of which expire at the end of the year, except, of course, for the temporary cut in the payroll tax, which expires at the end of February.
Presumably chief among these in the consideration are the Bush tax cuts. Does the future of those have to be decided before the presidential election in November or not if they expire at the end of the year now?
Well, so those are scheduled to expire December 31st, and, you know, one option would be for Congress and the president to address those in a lame duck session after we know who the new Congress and new president are going to be, so do that in November, December. That would be consistent with the sort of legislating by crisis that Congress has engaged in recently, right? You'll remember the debt limit debate, which came down to the last moment, and the government shutdown debate, which came down to the last moment. So one option on the tax cuts would be to do that. Another possibility would be that there'd be some pressure to address them before the election if enough members of Congress don't want to appear to be willing to let taxes go up. My guess is that's less likely. I would suspect they wait until till the 11th hour.
So tax is a hot issue this year and going to stay hot as we approach the presidential election and maybe beyond. We're going to hear later in this hour from President George W. Bush's, the chief economist on his Council of Economic Advisors, Douglas Holtz Aiken. But Douglas Marin, if you'd stand by right now, I want to bring in Ronald McKinnon. He's a professor of international economics at Stanford University. His recent and much debated op-ed piece on the conservative editorial page of the Wall Street Journal was headlined "The Conservative Case for a Wealth Tax." Ronald McKinnon, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, I'm very pleased to be here.
Let's just define our terms for a moment. This is something most Americans wouldn't even be familiar with. Not an income tax, but a tax on people's accumulated net wealth is what you're proposing.
That's right. And that includes real assets like housing, yachts, mansions, and so forth, as well as financial assets.
We'll look at the details of what you're proposing, but first of all, you describe yourself as a small C conservative. What's a conservative doing proposing a tax on wealth?
Well, I'm very concerned with the federal fiscal deficit, which is huge, which then is the basis for our trade deficit, since we have to borrow so heavily from friendly Chinese to support our government. They own a huge amount of our treasury bonds. So I'd like to get us out of that box by a big rise in domestic taxes that doesn't distort decision-making. And the income tax, we can't raise at the margin anymore without badly distorting how hard people will work. If you go up to very high marginal income tax rates, this is very, very problematic in terms of both revenue collection and in pushing people out of the tax-paying group.
So what you're proposing, and I know since you've got a lot of feedback on this, you may have be doing some rethinking or modifying, but what you proposed in your essay, The Conservative Case for a Wealth Tax, was that you would look at the wealth of individual American citizens, give them an exemption of $3 million. That would
That's
exclude
right.
95% of the population. And then the rest of their wealth would be taxed annually, you were proposing, at 3% on everything that remained. Have I got that right?
That's right. Okay, so the income tax, as people get wealthier, the income tax becomes worse and worse as something to tax, because all their income comes in form of capital gains, carried interest for hedge funds, or the implicit return on owning mansions, Italian villas, pied a terre in Paris. It's just the income tax breaks down for the very wealthy. But you can define wealth quite well, and that's what I'd like to tax. And because of the torrent of criticism I got my Wall Street Journal op-ed, I've raised my proposed basic exemption from $3 million to $6 million for a person's estate. But it would still stay as a 3% tax. So,
and this would be in addition to a flat tax. You would change the whole income tax structure to a flat tax, whether it would be considerably lower than it is now on the higher end.
Yeah, no, I think it's the key to reforming the income tax. You see, Warren Buffett convinced Barack Obama it was legitimate to raise the marginal tax, income tax, on people like him, and he is currently in about a 17% category for his declared income that's not sheltered in other ways. And it would go up somewhat if Obama took his advice and moved the tax rate marginal from 35% to 39.5%.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about taxes and the wealthy and a conservative's call for a new wealth tax, a tax straight on great fortune. Mitt Romney says he pays maybe 15% on his income. Ronald McKinnon would tax his net worth, his net wealth itself. He joins us today from Stanford, California, professor of economics there. His op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal was headlined, "The Conservative Case for a Wealth Tax." Donald Marin is with us as well, director of the Tax Policy Center, joining us today from Washington, D.C. Donald Marin, I want to hear you on this, and Ronald McKinnon, I want to get more detail, but a couple of our listeners first. Penn in Charlottesville, Virginia. Penn, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I would just one direct comment that I think a tax directed at accumulated wealth makes a lot more sense, especially considering, you know, the fiscal situation that our federal government is in. And I think that makes more sense than only limiting them to dividends and smaller smaller tax rates such as capital gains. I think it makes a lot of sense.
But does it sound fair to you, Penn? After all, people have paid presumably some kind of taxes on this wealth already as they gained it.
Absolutely, it seems fair to me. I think, you know, when you think of an actual percentage of wealth per person and what we pay in taxes, you know, a majority of our country is middle and lower class, and we have a very small percentage that have massive accumulated wealth, and they continue to grow on accumulated interest on in dividends and stocks and investments without having to pay, you know, a considerable amount of tax on that accumulated wealth. And it doesn't trickle down at all. One or two $100,000 jobs that these people create a year doesn't make sense. It doesn't make up for all their accumulated wealth. There's no need that any human being should have such a vast amount of money or possessions or you know, property or anything else.
Yeah, Penn, we've got it. Boy, it's really interesting. Talk about unintended consequences. You cut the tax rate on capital gains, and a few years later, there's a call for an actual tax on wealth itself. I appreciate your call, Penn. Daniel in Nashville, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make the point, while I'm not a huge fan of the wealthy people in the country accumulating vast amounts of wealth and just hoarding it, a tax on wealth just sounds like a tax on frugality to me. Like, it's the principle of the thing, I suppose, and what would be the harm in just re-raising the capital gains tax? I know it was higher than this in the past, so why not just raise it back up?
Interesting question. Ronald McKinnon, let me come to you, and then Donald, I'll come to you. But, you know, what about the concern here that this would just be a tax on frugality? Here's another listener online writes, "Why punish savers and investors?" What about those perspectives, Ronald?
Well, many wealthy people have income which is not taxed at all, what ordinary people would consider to be income. For example, unrealized capital gains, which are huge in the case of Warren Buffett and Mitt Romney, are not taxed till realized, and they may never be realized if that becomes part of their estate. A second thing is that you have the imputed rental value of real assets.
What does that mean? That's kind of a that's an unfamiliar idea.
Well, let me give an example that Barry Bonds, you know, the baseball player,
sure,
is under house arrest in Southern California in Beverly Hills. He has this huge mansion he paid about $15 million for, and he's confined to this mansion.
Mm-hmm.
But the imputed rental value of the mansion is not part of his federal tax obligation.
Why should it be? He owns it. It's his. Why should he pay rent to live in it?
Yeah, he owns it. But he, you know, if he'd invested in bonds, sorry for that, got 15, got 3 or 4% on his bond holding, that's fully taxable. If he invests in a huge mansion, $15 million, he gets imputed return.
I see.
Imputed rental.
Yeah.
And that's not taxable. And as you know, the very wealthy have many houses. They'll have a mansion in Long Island, a pied-à-terre in Paris, an Italian villa, a nice apartment overlooking San Francisco Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And this all is an incredible stream of imputed income, but nothing that is taxable.
Donald Marin, our caller says, why not just, if you're really worried about the accumulated wealth here and what the wealthy are chipping in to, for this country's expenses and on its deficit, why not just raise the capital gains tax rate again? Which of these looks more or less likely to you, Donald? You watch this all the time, a wealth tax or a higher capital gains tax again?
Oh, well, if you're asking me to politically prognosticate, a higher capital gains tax rate is much more likely. In fact, you know, one of the things that's often overlooked is that Congress passed and the president signed into law an increase in the capital gains rate that goes into effect January 1st next year.
Up to 20% again?
No, not the 20%.
Oh.
It's as part of health reform for high-income taxpayers, a new 3.8% tax on investment income was passed.
Oh.
And so even if all of the expiring tax cuts get extended, we're still going to see the cap gains rate go up to a little bit more, you know, close to 19%. So a little bit of that is already baked in the cake.
So they're headed up. A wealth tax itself, Ronald McKinnon makes the case for it. Do you think, is that a dead-in-the-water idea in this country? It's been done in Europe. Donald?
So,
Donald, let me
yes.
put that to you first, if I may. I'll come to you, Professor McKinnon.
I think a wealth tax would be a very heavy lift. But I want to emphasize, if you think about the wealth tax, really the point that the professor is making is an important one, which there are two kinds of wealth in America.
Mm-hmm.
There's the kind of wealth that regularly generates income that can be taxed relatively well through an income tax. And so a good example would be a bond, right? Suppose you go out and you buy a treasury bond, a 10-year treasury bond today, and it pays you 3% interest. It's very straightforward to levy a tax on that. And if you came along and did a wealth tax, a 3% wealth tax, you know, that would be the moral equivalent of doing a 100% tax rate on that treasury, right? So it's paying you 3% in interest, but then
mm-hmm.
you got to send it back to the government to pay your 3% wealth tax.
Yep.
And I think that fairly looks like a tax on frugality. On the other hand, you have, you know, investments in corporations where the investor never sells it, so they never realize a capital gain. Or you have the ownership of, as he was describing, you know, mansions and yachts and cars and art, which provide income in the form of happiness that you get to enjoy them, but
mm-hmm.
that's something that the tax authorities never get to see. And those go untaxed. And so there is a very interesting and important issue about how we tax those. At the state level, the way we tax those in part, of course, is with a property tax,
right?
Which is, in fact, a wealth tax
mm-hmm.
that just
yeah.
applies to your residences.
What about the potential impact of this on our deficit situation, Donald Marin? Can you imagine this having a real impact on that? This is a kind of an unfamiliar, strange idea to many Americans, but we got maybe a problem here. If we did it, could it really make a difference in the scale of the deficit?
It depends on the parameters of the tax, how big the basic exemption for the wealth tax is
mm-hmm.
and how much the rate is. So we'd have to get someone like the Congressional Budget Office to pass on how much revenue we need and how the tax should be levied. But Mr. Holtz-Eakin made a good point that there are...
This is Donald Marin now. We'll hear from Douglas Holtz-Eakin in a moment. But I'm sorry, Professor McKinnon, your point?
There are taxes already on earned income in the form of unearned income in the form of dividends and capital gains, mm-hmm. and people, this is productive activity for many people. But the imputed rent on mansions, yachts, and so forth is not taxed at all. This is unproductive capital, and we should bring that into the tax net.
Donald Marin in Washington, what's your sense of what kind of impact this might have on our balance sheet, on our bottom line nationally?
Oh, I mean, you could certainly raise, if you figured out a way to do this, you could raise some, you know, we haven't done an estimate, but some decent amount of money. The reality is, though, there are ultimately limits to how much revenue you can raise from the highest income folks. You know, even with the astounding wealth that the Warren Buffetts and Mitt Romneys have, the reality is that the vast, you know, tax base of America is more the middle class and the upper middle class. And that, you know, if in the future we're going to need substantially more tax revenue to pay for rising healthcare costs and the aging population, if that's a decision we make as a nation, you know, the reality is that we're going to have to look for taxes that affect the average American, not just the highest end.
And Ronald McKinnon in Stanford, California, is this about fixing the deficit to your mind, or is it about fairness?
Yeah, it's about both, actually. You can solve both with one weapon, actually, the wealth tax. See, I want to improve the operation of the income tax by making it flatter and fewer exemptions.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with the income tax, if you reduce the top rate to make it flatter, you exempt the very wealthy.
Yes, okay, from so that higher rate.
We want a flat income tax. And so to get that, we have to go to the people and say, well, we are taxing the very wealthy with this wealth tax.
Mm-hmm.
So the wealth tax is a necessary condition for reforming the income tax.
A kind of political necessary condition. What about the
political condition?
What about the wealthy themselves? Would they all, you know, we learned in the last 24 hours, Mitt Romney has a bunch of money parked in the Cayman Islands. Maybe and we've already heard of wealthy Americans even giving up their citizenship to, you know, sort of just leaving the country. Could you imagine that, Ronald McKinnon? The wealthy would say, hey, I'm not sticking around here and watching a 3% ding on my net worth every year.
Yes. Well, the you might remember back in 2008, the Union Bank of Switzerland was fined $780 million for sheltering the bank accounts of wealthy Americans, hiding them from the U.S. tax collector. And they've now agreed to reveal all these accounts. And mm-hmm. the Internal Revenue Service is going after the smaller Swiss banks as well. So they are, and I think the Cayman Islands would be next in line. So the Congress was so outraged by this Union Bank of Switzerland thing that they passed in 2010 the Foreign Account Tax Compliant Act, or FATCA, which now forces foreign financial institutions to report directly to the U.S. Treasury. I think that's a great idea, and it would be greatly help with the collection of the wealth tax as well as the ordinary income tax.
Let's go to Marcia in Iowa City. Marcia, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
I'm happy to talk to you, Tim. Good day.
You too. Hi, what's up?
Say, I don't know. You know, I listened to Mitt Romney and what he's got to say and what people say about him and his financial situation, and I think he's just totally taken advantage of opportunities that the average American will never see.
So, would you go for a wealth tax or no, Marcia?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's no reason when people have a zillion dollars that they can't contribute some of that on a regular basis to some of the entitlements that people like me, disabled senior citizens, getting by on $20,000 a year,
mm-hmm.
there's no reason they can't help. And I'm considered middle class. The very, very poor in this country are getting left behind so quick. Nobody, I don't hear anybody talking about it. It's all middle class, and it's like, whoa.
So, Marcia, you're putting your hand up. Yeah, we hear it. You put your hand up right away and say yes for a wealth tax when you got $20,000 a year. It might sound like a good idea, and many people are at that level. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Jim in Savannah, Georgia. Jim, what do you think?
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I would say let's swap the income tax and the capital gains tax around. Give us the capital gains rate, the people that are working, and give the capital gains people our income tax rate. I'm not for a wealth tax, because I feel like people who own property that's not bringing in income
mm-hmm.
can't afford to pay that mm-hmm. wealth tax. But mm-hmm. if they are bringing in income, they should be taxed on that at that rate. But then if you've got the people that own property, own houses, they're paying property taxes. They're paying maintenance on those properties.
Mm-hmm.
They're paying for people to look after them and provide jobs and all that. So if it's not producing income, then I don't think it should be taxed. But if it is producing income, then it should be taxed.
So never mind the imputed value. It's the income you want to look at, Jim. Ronald McKinnon, what about that? You could have people with a high net worth, but it may be very illiquid. Maybe it's tied up in a family business or a family farm. How would they come up with the cash to pay the tax?
Once they knew the wealth tax was a law, then they would become more liquid, right? They just hold more liquid assets.
Is that good for the country
that
if they sold
tax.
A family business or sold a family farm to be more liquid?
They don't have to go that far, but you plan, you know, when you have withdrawals from your 401k that are required for retired people, you make sure you liquefy some of this so you can actually have the mandatory withdrawals. But I would like to stress one mm-hmm. point here. We're not dealing with ordinary people, middle-income people at all. We're only dealing with the top 1% of the population. So I want the basic exemption on the wealth tax to be very substantial.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take then Warren Buffett, so when he convinced Barack Obama that he should raise the marginal income tax.
Mm-hmm.
In 2010, Warren Buffett had paid about $7 million in his income tax. And when we had the suggested increase in the marginal tax rate, it would go up to $14 million. His taxable income was just under $40
million. Yep.
But his wealth is $47 billion. You've got to get the decimal point right.
Billion.
Here. Billion, yeah. So we're still dealing with a few millions in what he was paying on income tax.
I get that, but I have
it
to...
It is a wealth of $47 billion.
It's huge, but I have to... In what sense is this a conservative plan, Ronald McKinnon? Here, a listener writes online, smells like the tyranny of the majority to me. Now, I hear the case made for it. We've got listeners making it. But in what the headline here is a conservative case for... How is this conservative?
Yeah, well, my... I stick by the conservative case, but my original title for the Wall Street Journal was Flat Taxes, Income or Wealth? And they changed the title to a conservative case for wealth tax.
But you agree that it's a conservative case. Why? What makes it conservative?
Well, because I want it as a means of reforming the income tax
mm-hmm.
to reduce loopholes and flatten the tax structure. And all the Republicans have all wanted a flat tax, income tax, but they forget about the fact you've got to raise revenue. So the wealth tax does two things. It raises the revenue you might lose from the wealthy if you cut their marginal income tax rate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also seen by ordinary people to be much fairer.
Donald Mayer, we've just got you for another half minute here. You're a good sport to stick with us. I mean, the point that Ronald McKinnon makes right there goes to your point that a lot of the tax plans being proposed on the Republican primary circuit, by your calculation anyway, lead to a greater deficit. I mean, you've got to fill that somehow if you want a flatter tax.
Yes, right. If you want to cut tax rates and have a flatter, lower tax rates, you know, you can fill in some of it by filling in the Swiss cheese of our tax code. You know, we
mm-hmm.
haven't had a chance to talk today, but there are an enormous number of tax preferences out there
mm-hmm.
that weaken our tax system and force rates higher than they have to be. And so the first round of tax reform really ought to be to fill in those holes and then use that money to help address the deficit.
A lot of ideas flying around here. Donald Mayer at the Tax Policy Center in Washington, director there. Thank you so much for being with us today, Donald.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about taxes and the wealthy. And one conservative's call for a new wealth tax, a tax straight on great fortunes. Mitt Romney says he pays maybe 15% of his income. Ronald McKinnon would tax his net worth, his net wealth itself. He's professor of international economics at Stanford University. His op-ed piece in the conservative Wall Street Journal op-ed page was headlined, The Conservative Case for a Wealth Tax. Douglas Holtz-Aiken joins us right now from Arlington, Virginia, president of the American Action Forum. It's a right-leaning economic policy think tank. From 2001 to 2, he was chief economist of President George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. 03 to 05, director of the Congressional Budget Office. 07-08, director of domestic and economic policy for the John McCain presidential campaign. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So we're in a funny time. An unusual time, let's say, when the Wall Street Journal has this on its op-ed page. But people are really kind of getting up in arms about the way wealth is distributed and about the deficit. They're looking for new solutions, Douglas Holtz-Aiken. What do you think of this one?
Well, I have more reservations, I think, than Mr. McKinnon does. And they center on the fact that tax policy has many objectives, and while fairness is one of them, and certainly raising the revenue to pay our bills is an important part of it, there are also issues in compliance, being able to administer the tax code, collect the revenue efficiently, and economic growth. And we've had some experience with wealth taxes. We've had an estate tax in the United States for a long, long time,
mm-hmm.
and there's a growing literature that shows that it is far from a benign instrument of social justice, that instead of that, it turns out to be a real impediment to the growth, especially of small businesses and family businesses in the United States. It leads them to undertake less investment. It leads them to hire fewer workers. And research by Joel Sumrall at the University of Michigan shows it actually inhibits overall wealth accumulation and thus the standard of living in the United States. And in the process, remarkably enough, it turns out that it's not the rich who are bearing the burden of that tax. It's the workers. It's the people who would have been hired, who would have had better equipment. And that lesson on a small piece of what would be a wealth tax, I think, is one mm-hmm. you have to keep in mind when you think about having a very broad wealth tax.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, I know that you have some of your own ideas on a kind of flat tax, and I want to look at those. But let's take this critique to Ronald McKinnon. What about the notion, the argument, Ronald McKinnon, that this a wealth tax would be an impediment to economic growth?
Well, I think if it just affects the top 1% of the population, it won't. That most people will go on doing what they do, being productive. But the very, very wealthy will have to worry about how to pay quite a large tax. Now, Douglas Holtz-Eakin made a point, well, let's just concentrate on fixing loopholes in the income tax. But the two biggest loopholes in the current income tax is to allow charitable and philanthropic contributions. And the second is to not tax the imputed rental value of property, homes, mansions, yachts,
yep.
and so forth.
Yeah.
Now, none of these have any congressional support. As a matter of fact, all the Republicans who wanted a flatter tax wanted to keep these two loopholes. And I think these are the loopholes that benefit the very wealthy, like Mitt Romney, when he gave several hundred million dollars to the Mormon Church. That was tax advantaged because it's a philanthropic contribution. I have nothing against the Mormons. I think they're great people. But I don't think Uncle Sam should be part of their financing, nor do I think that for any other church.
Professor McKinnon, if I may, I think it was Donald Maron who was talking about loopholes. We'll look at that with Douglas Holtz-Aiken as well. But let me, if I may, come back once more to this idea that a wealth tax would be an impediment to growth. You say, well, not really, because it's just the top 1%. But if you look at the concentration of capital in the top 1% of our population, it is so big. Some people say 35% of the country's wealth in that top 1%, that if that was somehow less productive, that big a chunk of our national wealth, wouldn't that be a problem?
You're almost making my case for you, for me.
Okay.
If you get everybody's wealth, then it becomes quite inelastic to the tax. If you only try and tax one thing, people will switch to other things. But a general wealth tax is something that's not easy to get out of if it's properly employed. It's inelastic. So it's a good tax to impose. And what you're getting is non-productive consumption assets, mansions, yachts, and so forth, as well as productive assets. You're getting unrealized capital gains, the very wealthy, which are so important to them. So I think this isn't going to interfere with economic growth. If you can rationalize the income tax, keep rates for ordinary people moderate because you have a wealth tax on the wealthy
in place, this will be a net plus.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, if what we're talking about here is going after non-productive assets, putting a tax in effect in no small part on, you know, second yachts and third and fourth and fifth mansions, maybe that's not a ding on growth.
Yeah. Well, let me just pick up on what was said and just, again, go back and emphasize a couple of things. Number one, all tax policy is, in the end, trade-offs among different objectives, and no single objective, fairness or growth, or typically triumphs. We have social policy in our tax code. We have growth efforts. We have fairness efforts. And, but when we do that, we really ought to look at the record and not just the theory. And everything that Mr. McKinnon just said about his wealth tax has been said about the U.S. estate tax. Very few people are supposed to be in it. It's only for the very rich. They're, in fact, dead, so how possibly could they respond to this tax? Yet if you look at the growing body of research, it turns out that the tax rate that matters is not the tax rate that's actually levied on the estate. It's the tax rate that people are looking at in their most productive years, from about 35 to 55, because not everyone knows if they're going to end up in the top 1%, but they do actually have to do some business calculations, and they might. And so it affects more broadly than the people who actually end up sending checks into the U.S. Treasury. And I worry that a casual assumption that this has no impact, and thus setting the growth impacts at zero, leads us to a very bad tax policy. And there are better alternatives, quite frankly, because the whole notion that we want to somehow have a tax code that distinguishes between productive and unproductive, non-productive uses of income, I think is very misplaced. We ought to have a tax code that taxes people on what they take out of the economy and doesn't tax them on what they put in. And quite frankly, if we taxed you on your consumption, what you took out of the economy in a progressive fashion, so that if you have a Paris Hilton of a big expensive lifestyle versus a Sam Walton who lived a very frugal lifestyle, they might both be rich, but they're not the same. We should tax one more heavily than the other. And then we're getting at the right thing. And if you're putting your capital to work in the economy, and it's not just sitting idly in some IRA or 401k, it's being used by American businesses, American universities to finance the skills, technologies, and capital we need. If you're contributing that, I think that we want to reward that. And if you're contributing your efforts on the labor front, we want to reward that. And instead, let's tax people on what they bring out. So a tax on consumed income gets the division right, and it's actually the tax code we ought to look for.
We'll look at that. Let me get a couple callers in here first. Joe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I want to say that I find some of this discussion about wealth taxing to be quite disturbing. It sounds very much communistic to me. It sounds like we're talking about taking from each according to his means and giving to each according to his needs. And if you go back and look at some of the Karl Marx planks in his Communist Manifesto, he talks about things like preferring a heavy, progressive, and graduated income tax and abolition of all rights of inheritance. And that's exactly what I'm seeing here today. That kind of scares me a little bit.
Ronald McKinnon, Joe, let me take it right to Professor McKinnon. Professor McKinnon, is this rank communism you're putting forth?
Yeah, I've been accused of being a communist in several letters to the Wall Street Journal and on the blog. That's true. But what I really want to do is rationalize the income tax and close loopholes and keep the rates fairly flat so ordinary working people can keep most of their income and save and so forth. The only people I really want are the top 1%, and that's why we want a big exemption for the wealth tax. And I'm not going to try and make a distinction between productive and unproductive assets. It's just all assets. The owner can classify them as productive or unproductive, but a modest tax on all wealth would be good, like Warren Buffett's $47 billion worth.
But is there something in fundamental American principle that our caller Joe from Pittsburgh says, this just doesn't sound right to him. This sounds like it should be outside the realm of our consideration, Professor McKinnon.
Well, I don't know what the matter of principle are. We've tried to use the income tax in a very progressive way to flatten wealthy people. Like there used to be a 90% marginal income tax back in the 1960s. Even in the 1970s, it was 70% until Ronald Reagan dropped it a lot. And he finally got it down by 1986 to 28%. But it's just that the income tax is a very bad way of taxing the wealthy, because once you get a flat tax to benefit most people, middle-income people, Ronald Reagan's now remembered today for reducing taxes on the very wealthy. So what we want is a flat tax, all right, but we have to compensate by putting taxes on the very wealthy, and that's where the wealth tax comes in.
Douglas, I'll take it. I'll bring that to you. One call first. Ruth in Westwood, Massachusetts. Ruth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Edmund Morris did an article quoting Theodore Roosevelt a couple of years ago, and, you know, he was a progressive, but that was 100 years ago. And what Roosevelt said, the Republican Roosevelt, great corporations exist only because they are created and safeguarded by our institutions, and it's therefore our right and duty to see that they work in harmony with these corporations, with these institutions. And he also said vast capitals of capital, personal capital, create new conditions and necessitate a change from the old attitude of the state and nation towards regulating.
Ruth, summarize for us. The quote is losing me here, but what do you take from it?
I think that what Theodore Roosevelt said was that people who make much more money owe it like jill to this country. Without this country's principles, they would not be making this money. And I think that they owe it to the country.
They make a lot from the country. They owe it to the country, maybe particularly when the country's finances are in trouble. Ruth, I appreciate your call. We'll look at it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. All right, Douglas Holtz-Aiken, first to that point. I mean, we've got big problems budget-wise in this country. Now, some would say just cut and cut to fix that, though that can have its own negative economic repercussions if there's too much austerity, I guess. But what about the notion that, you know, this is a country where wealth is made out of the bounty and investments and commonweal investments? If we need to turn to the wealthy to sort of come back in and help us out when things are dire on the fiscal side, why not?
So, 3 points, and try not to turn this into a sermon. Point number one is let's respect the lessons of history and facts. And history is that the kind of tax reform that Mr. McKinnon is talking about, something like the 1986 tax reform, unwound very quickly. And the reason it unwound so quickly is that it tried to tax, in the modern global economy, the return to saving and investment, the interest, dividends, capital gains you hear so much about, at the same rates as ordinary income. And it turns out it's just completely impractical to do that. And you ought to design a tax system that's not going to unwind in front of your very eyes. And that's why I think going to something that looks like a system of IRAs, where if you put it in, it's not taxed. When you take it out, it is far more practical. Second thing is, let's remember who's paying the taxes. 47% of Americans pay no income tax. So the income tax is, in fact, a surtax on high-income Americans already. And for that reason, it ought to be configured to the economic lives of high-income Americans, which means that you ought to respect the fact that they are the ones doing the saving, investing, and providing the seed corn for faster economic growth. And that, I think, is the final point, which is, if you look at the lessons of history for countries that have our problem is large debt and projected enormous explosion in debt and bad economic growth, what those lessons say is reform taxes to make them more pro-growth, tax consumption, not saving investment and wealth accumulation, and cut transfer programs to get the budget under control. And we need to run that playbook because we need to grow. We have millions of Americans out of work.
But the thing is, we've cut taxes kind of on the GOP playbook. Did it in the Reagan decade, did it in the George W. Bush decade, and our deficits grew a lot.
But there's no sensible numerical accounting that can attribute the bulk of our deficits to, say, the Bush tax cuts or anything like that. We have a very simple accounting for what happened between 2000 and now, and that says the tax cuts are responsible for something about 20% of the increase in deficits. The economy is responsible for about 50%. Increases in spending are responsible for the rest. And so the bulk of our deficit explosion has been bad economic performance. We need to have better economic performance and increased spending programs. And if you look forward, it is clearly spending that is the problem, The president's own fiscal commission, the Bowles-Simpson Commission, just said it beautifully, said it's a national moment of truth. Our problem is largely spending, and it's all kinds of spending. We need to get serious about cutting it.
Douglas Holtzake, and he was director of the Congressional Budget Office, chief economist to George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ronald McKinnon, last word goes to you here. You put the stick in all this and got everybody riled up. Take us back to your basic argument about why the wealthy might want to be open to paying a tax on their wealth.
Well, they won't want to, but nobody wants to pay taxes if they can legally avoid them. But I want to set up a tax structure that actually hits just the very wealthy. The middle class, people on wage and salary income, are taxed quite well. They have withholding on their salary income. They have Social Security deductions. Mm-hmm. And anyone on with wage income is taxed quite heavily. But the wealthy have their income in much different forms on returns on wealth, carried interest for hedge fund managers, capital gains, as Mitt Romney's had in his portfolio. This is not easily subject to an income tax. If you have a high capital gains tax, then that really does discourage a lot of risk-taking. However, if you have a modest wealth tax on sedentary individuals, people, for example, with inherited wealth, who are not touched at all much by the current income tax, would be hit by my wealth tax proposal.
Time to do it, says Ronald McKinnon, the conservative case for a wealth tax in the Wall Street Journal. Professor McKinnon, thank you so much for joining us today. This is On Point.